Support comes from the Norton Simon Museum. Celebrate the opening of I Saw It, Francisco de Goya Printmaker, with an evening of live music, art making, live model drawing, tours, and more. Saturday, April 20th from 4 to 6:30 p.m. Info at nortonsimon.org.
Good afternoon, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle, special time on this Monday. Hope you had a good weekend. If you were out to join us at the Theater at Ace Hotel yesterday for our 18th annual Film Week Academy Awards preview, hope you had a wonderful time. More than 1,000 Film Week fans there to see all our critics on stage at the Ace, watch clips of the film. We had a great time and hope you did too. If you missed it, we hope you'll join us next year for our annual edition of the Academy Awards preview at the historic Theater at Ace Hotel. As you just heard from NPR, closing arguments in President Trump's impeachment trial, we are finally, it appears, into the home stretch. There'll be some speeches tomorrow on the floor of the Senate, and then Wednesday's scheduled afternoon vote, scheduled for 1 o'clock our time on Wednesday afternoon. With us to talk about the arguments that were made by each side to close out today, Ron Elving, NPR senior editor. Ron, thank you for joining us. Your thoughts about the closing arguments from both sides?
There was a good deal of passion. There was more passion, perhaps, than I was expecting. We have obviously exhausted a great amount of material, a great amount of time, and a great number of senators who are really having a hard time sitting still through all these proceedings. But there was passion today, especially, I would say, in the closing remarks of Hakeem Jeffries, one of the House managers, and then the closing remarks, of course, of Adam Schiff, very familiar to your listeners. Both of them bringing a great deal of passion to what they talked about, and also the president's defenders asking the senators essentially to restore the balance in the system that they see having been destroyed by the Democrats, House managers in particular, coming over to the Senate and accusing the president of impeachable offenses.
And tomorrow there are going to be speeches on the floor of the House. Is that just essentially for senators who want to be on the record and you know, to have those clips of either condemnation or support for the president?
Yes, as I understand it, the Court of Impeachment has adjourned. We will not see John Roberts return, as I understand it. And the rest of today and all of tomorrow until the State of the Union time in the evening, and then Wednesday up until 4 o'clock Eastern time, about 1 o'clock your time, there will be time for speeches of up to 10 minutes each by as many senators as wish to express themselves. And they will express themselves by trying to explain their own votes and their own thinking about how they're going to vote.
And Ron, is that likely to be where we see the speeches, in front of an empty chamber? They're generally done for television, or would you anticipate there would be significant numbers of senators in attendance for those speeches?
As a general rule, senators do not show up to listen to each other's Senate speeches. They sometimes might just be caught on the floor planning to speak themselves or having some other business there, and they may stick around. Sometimes you'll see a knot of two or three senators listening to another. Generally, though, it's clerks and staff and television cameras, and the television cameras don't show you how empty the chamber is. They just show you the senator who is speaking. Now, there are exceptions to this. At the time of the vote on Brett Kavanaugh, there were some significant speeches given that announced votes that we were really hanging on, and quite a few senators seemed to be present for those, almost as though they were there to enforce a certain sense of party discipline, or perhaps just out of curiosity to see how certain wavering senators might vote.
So on Wednesday afternoon is the scheduled vote on impeachment itself and whether the president will be removed from office. That's widely expected to be non-removal, the vote, as the Republican majority is held for that. What comes after that? Or do they recess after the vote? And if they vote not to remove the president, that's just it?
That is just it. The president goes on about his business. The senators go back to their business. The House managers have already concluded, so they are going to clear out of the Senate chamber and go back to their own side of the building, which is not that far, but it is another world. It's the other side of the Capitol, and it is quite a world unto itself. So things will go back more or less to normal. It's not to say that memories will fade immediately But we don't see a lot of suspense in the vote. Perhaps the greatest suspense at this point is whether there will be some Democrats who vote not to remove the president from office.
What about the State of the Union address tomorrow night? It'll be 6 o'clock Pacific time. We'll have live NPR coverage of the State of the Union to be given by President Trump tomorrow at 6. Is there anticipation that the president might in some way address the impeachment process?
Of course, we're thinking he might. Of course, we're thinking he would be tempted to do so, especially because he will surely feel confident that he's going to survive it, and he would like to take a victory lap there in the House chamber, where the senators will all be present, along with all the members of the House and the members of the Supreme Court and most of the members of the cabinet and a lot of other people he would like to be able to look at and say, see, here I am. You can't touch me. I'm going to survive this process just fine. Are you? But on the other hand, it would probably be advisable for the sake of calmness, I suppose, and to some degree, whatever bipartisanship there might be left in Congress, and for the sake of his own peace within the party, the Republican Party, that the president would desist and not go there and not talk about it. We have an example. 1999, Bill Clinton, in the midst of his impeachment trial, gave his State of the Union address on January 19th, 1999, and never mentioned impeachment.
Yeah. And you can see stylistically and just temperamentally why that would be in this case, even with Republicans in the Senate urging the president not to touch it during the State of the Union. One wonders if he'll be able to resist that.
That is probably the greatest goad to audience tuning in to hear the speech, to see what he will do with it, if anything. It certainly was in 1999. Everyone was on the edge of their seat wondering how he would speak of it. And he just chose not to. And that at the time was widely applauded and thought to have been wise.
Before I let you go, Ron, thank you again for the time. Quick thought on today's Iowa caucuses and their significance.
The significance is that in general, back since 1996 and in each cycle since 1996, the winner of the Iowa caucus, even if it was a narrow win, goes on to be the Democratic nominee. Now, you can't necessarily predict that in this case because there are so many candidates and because there's so much yet that could happen. But lots of people are going to wake up tomorrow morning and look at how well Bernie Sanders did. And at this point, I think most of the handicappers in Iowa are thinking he's the man to beat. He's the front runner in Iowa tonight. And whether that reflects all Iowans or all Iowa Democrats or not, it will reflect that minor fraction that are willing to come out on Monday night. He's got a lot of enthusiastic supporters. So if they are all out there for him, he'll probably win. And when he does, a lot of people are going to wake up tomorrow morning and go, could we really have a presidential election between Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders? And the answer is yes, we could.
Ron, great to talk with you again. Thank you so much. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Larry.
NPR senior editor and correspondent on the Washington desk, Ron Elving, joining us on 89.3 KPCC. In case you just tuned in, we're on with a belated air talk today, an abbreviated version of the program, taking you up to the BBC NewsHour at 1 o'clock. Take 2 with A. Martinez coming up at 2. All the regularly scheduled programs, Marketplace, The Frame, All Things Considered, coming your way right here on 89.3 KPCC. With us, Anna Edgerton, politics editor for Bloomberg. Anna, we appreciate your being with us again. Let me continue in the vein that I was on there with Ron Elving. Your thoughts about Iowa, the significance of the caucuses today?
Well, it's going to be a very important day, especially for those four front runners. And you know, all of them have kind of made their case that they're the best to beat Donald Trump. And now we're going to see what the first set of voters actually think about that. So it's very important to kind of get those first results, which will really end up setting the pace for the rest of the, at least the initial early states.
It seems to me the pressure is a bit more on Sanders, just as we were talking about, because he's perceived to be the front runner in Iowa, even though the polls are pretty close there. And I wonder your thoughts on it. Is in a sense, there more at stake and Sanders really needs a win tonight?
I would actually argue that there's maybe even more pressure on Elizabeth Warren and Pete Buttigieg, just because Biden has such a kind of unique place in the hearts of his supporters and really around the country. He has kind of strong grassroots support and kind of a brand that no other candidate has. Same goes for Joe Biden, but in a very different way. You know, he's a known entity. He has kind of made the case that he's the best to beat Trump. But for Elizabeth Warren and Pete Buttigieg, they really need to show that they have support that can get them through the nominating contest and that they can maintain some front runner status. It deserves to be in that top tier. I think since Biden and Buttigieg are already kind of consolidated up there, kind of tied with each other, they really need to look to those lower polling candidates to see if they can solidify their place in the top tier.
And I think you meant Biden and Sanders, right? Not Biden and Buttigieg when you said that.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Just wanted to clarify. The Associated Press just reporting that radio host Rush Limbaugh announced today he's been diagnosed with advanced lung cancer. He told listeners on his program today that he's going to be taking some days off for further medical tests and to determine a course of treatment. Rush Limbaugh, the longtime conservative syndicated radio talk show host, very influential conservative voice, says he has advanced lung cancer and will be taking some time off from his radio program for treatment. We're talking with Anna Edgerton, politics editor for Bloomberg. And coming up in just a few minutes, we're going to talk with a reporter who's there in Iowa to set the scene with the caucuses coming up later today to explain a little bit about the process, how the second choice candidates play such a big role in Iowa in a way, of course, they don't in a conventional primary. So that's all coming up. And if you have questions about Iowa and about the process or any questions about what unfolded today in the closing arguments in the impeachment trial of President Trump, we're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722. Anna, your thoughts about the closing arguments today, now setting the stage for Wednesday afternoon's vote?
Well, it was a much more relaxed atmosphere in the chamber today. You can kind of see that senators had largely made their decisions. Much of the uncertainty has been resolved about this trial, and now we're kind of just going through the motions. We did see some of the similar closing arguments from the House prosecutors and Trump's defense that we've seen in previous days. And it was really just about kind of making that final pitch, not just to the senators in the room, but also to voters who are going to be making decisions in 2020 about President Trump, whether he deserves reelection, and also about some of the senators who had to sit as jurors on his impeachment trial.
And what's your sense of the concerns politically here? Because there could be some Democrats in the Senate who vote against removing the president from office. They're in states that have been supportive of President Trump. So clearly you've got, for some of the senators, serious political vulnerability.
That's right. And that's kind of the next thing that we're watching for as we get closer to Wednesday. I don't expect any Republicans to vote against the president, to vote to convict him on these two charges. It seems like even Susan Collins of Maine and Mitt Romney of Utah, who voted to call more witnesses, are going to have a really hard time actually voting to convict the president. However, there are about, you know, 3 to 5 Democrats that we're watching to see whether or not they could vote with Republicans to acquit the president. Now, this would be, you know, a demonstration that they are very independent minded, but it would also give President Trump a very strong talking point as he goes into his reelection campaign to say that he was acquitted on bipartisan terms.
We're talking with Anna Edgerton, politics editor for Bloomberg. Tomorrow night, the State of the Union address, 6 o'clock our time, NPR live coverage here on KPCC. Anna, what are you going to be looking for in that speech you think is going to be most interesting that the president could bring up?
Well, certainly whether or not he brings up impeachment, you know, I expect he'll at least mention it, but he was kind of getting some some casual counsel from Republicans in the hall today who are saying, I hope he doesn't actually spend too much time on impeachment because he has so many other things to talk about. You know, he could talk about the strength of the economy, you know, his Super Bowl ad yesterday that focused on criminal justice reform and some of the issues that the president has advanced during his first term that are important to voters, much more so than impeachment.
Anna, good to talk with you. We appreciate so much your being with us. Look forward to speaking with you again in the coming days.
My pleasure.
Anna Edgerton, politics editor for Bloomberg, joining us here on Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. And I just want to remind you, this is an abbreviated and late airing edition of Air Talk as we followed NPR's live coverage of the Senate impeachment trial of President Trump. Both sides presented their closing arguments today. Tomorrow is going to be a day of speeches by senators on the floor of the Senate chambers. And then Wednesday afternoon at 1 o'clock, the formal vote of whether to remove President Trump from office or not will be taken by the senators. And of course, NPR will have live coverage. Invite you to tune in at 5 o'clock this afternoon when we'll be bringing you NPR's live coverage of the Iowa caucuses. So as they're taking place, you'll be getting results from all the different caucuses taking place throughout the state of Iowa. The first opportunity for voters to cast their choice for the Democratic nominee. Speaking of which, we're going to be focusing on the Iowa caucuses in just a moment. We'll be back soon. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC.
Support for LAist comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting an evening in focus, Goya. The museum's galleries come to life at this interactive event, celebrating the opening of the exhibition, I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. Enjoy live music, art-making activities for all ages, live model drawing, tours, and more. Free with museum admission. Saturday, April 20th from 4 to 6:30 p.m. More information at nortonsimon.org.
Good to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Just a reminder, tomorrow we're back at our typical 10 o'clock time until noon here on 89.3 KPCC. Tomorrow there is nothing that we'll be covering necessarily when it comes to impeachment, as it's a day of speeches on the floor. Then Wednesday afternoon, 1 o'clock our time, will be the formal vote in the Senate. Well, as we've been mentioning, tonight the Iowa caucuses, first chance for American voters to make their selection between the Democratic presidential candidates. Joining us to talk about the caucus process, which I always feel like I have to relearn every 4 years, is James Lynch, reporter for The Gazette, based in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. James, good to have you with us today.
Good to be with you, Larry.
So let's start with the process, first of all. How are these caucuses run throughout the state? How do they work?
Well, basically, people gather in a specific location at 7 o'clock tonight, and after some sort of organizational, you know, chatter, they'll break into preference groups. People supporting Joe Biden will go off to one corner, Pete Buttigieg's supporters in another corner. And so everybody will be divided by who they support. And then they form what are called preference groups. And you have to have 15% of the people at that caucus in your preference group for the candidate to be viable to sort of move into the second round. And say you don't meet that 15% threshold, you have an opportunity to either go caucus with another candidate's preference group, or you can remain uncommitted. Sometimes uncommitted is a large percentage of caucus goers. And given how undecided people have been this year, I think it could be a significant number of caucus goers.
Yeah, and if someone going into the second round, for example, is uncommitted, could they in a third round decide they wanted to make a commitment? Or once they designate uncommitted, is that it for the rest of the caucus?
Well, they've made two changes this year, Larry. One is that if in the first round, if uncommitted is viable, then they remain in that preference group. They can't move to a second preference group. And the other change is that there's only one realignment this year. It doesn't go on and on. has in the past with three or four realignments. So it's just you basically get a first choice and a second choice, sort of a ranked choice voting operation.
Yeah, that's what it reminds me of exactly, as you said, rank choice, which some municipalities have experimented with that type of voting. If I'm not mistaken, San Francisco uses that. If you have questions about the process for caucuses in Iowa, you can give us a call. We're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722. You can also ask a question on the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. James, as you've traveled around, covered the different candidates. Just your sense of kind of, you know, where we stand at this point. Who, for lack of a better term, who's hot and who seems to be having a tougher time drawing crowds?
Well, in the last week or so, everybody's hot. But, you know, polling has shown us, and just looking at crowds that he's drawing, is that Bernie Sanders is very hot. He had a sort of a rally concert here Saturday night that drew 3,000 people, which is one of the bigger crowds of this campaign cycle. I would say Joe Biden's support is not red hot, but it's hot. Pete Buttigieg, too, is drawing big, enthusiastic crowds. Elizabeth Warren, maybe not as hot as she was. Some people say she peaked too early, and Amy Klobuchar is peaking too late. So I think one difference is that Bernie Sanders supporters seem to be much more committed than some other candidate supporters are. So I think everybody who has indicated Bernie is their first choice will be caucusing for him.
We're talking with James Lynch, reporter for the Gazette in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Covers politics, government, as well as the Iowa State Legislature. I was surprised to find out this morning, James, that snowbirds in Palm Springs who are from Iowa will have a caucus. There actually will be a caucus in Palm Springs, which is nice for those who for the winter come to the desert down here in Southern California. Were you aware of that?
Yeah, this is a first. Well, they tried it experimentally 4 years ago. There were four satellite caucuses. This year, there are 87. In fact, I just stepped out of a satellite caucus that started at 1:30 our time, and it's just concluded. And it was pretty evenly split between Bernie Sanders got two delegates, and Biden, Buttigieg, and Warren each got one delegate in that satellite caucus. But they're doing this to improve access for Iowans. And, yeah, there are a lot of Iowans who spend the winter in Arizona, Southern California, Texas, Florida. And so they're doing satellite caucuses there. There's one in Paris that my understanding is it's a group of mostly students from the University of Iowa who are on a study abroad semester. There's one in Glasgow, Scotland, and one in the Republic of Georgia. So the caucuses are worldwide now.
And that's fascinating. And are people specially trained in how to lead those caucuses?
The party does a lot of training. They've had training for caucus leaders. And a lot of times the people leading the caucuses have done it before. They're kind of old hands at it. The satellite caucus I just stepped out of, that wasn't the case. It took a long time to get organized. It took much longer to get organized than it did to actually do the caucusing. You know, for the most part, everybody's an amateur at this. You know, they may have some experience, but this happens once every 4 years. So it's kind of a learning, like you said at the beginning, at the top there, that you have to kind of relearn this process every 4 years.
We're talking with James Lynch, reporter for the Gazette in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Again, if you have questions for him about the process of the caucuses in Iowa, we're at 866-893-KPECC. James, is there a minimum number of people that have to show up for a caucus for it to be valid, or could any amount have their votes tabulated?
I don't think there's a minimum amount. You know, it certainly there are some precincts where turnout is going to be much lighter than others. Here in Cedar Rapids, you know, they're one of the challenges is finding places large enough for the caucuses, school cafeterias, gymnasiums, church halls, those sorts of things. You know, in some of the rural areas, turnout will be very small. You may have a half dozen people, you know, so caucus turnout, the record was in 2008, and I think it was like 16 or 18% of Democrats caucused that year. So you're not getting everyone. It's more people who are active in the party and committed to a candidate.
Yeah, this is the super core audience, I guess you would say. And then I wonder what the representation of younger people are going to be. Is it hard to get younger voters out to caucuses historically?
That's changed over the years because candidates have really targeted college campuses and reaching out to young people. There are a couple of smaller liberal arts colleges here in town, and there are active campaign organizations on those campuses at, University of Iowa, Iowa State. They're really making a strong push to get those students out to caucus. So, it's like voting that it skews older, but there is a high level of participation by younger voters.
Do Iowans really like the fact that they do caucuses instead of a conventional primary? Is this something that there's sort of a state pride in, or have there been serious conversations about changing it from a caucus to primary format?
Yes to all those questions.
Okay.
Iowans really like this. It's a tradition. There are people who have been doing it, since they were 18 years old, and they look forward to this and see it really as part of the civic process. There are people who don't like it, who think that it's too hard for people to be at a certain location at a certain time on a certain night, that there are people who advocate some sort of absentee ballots. The problem is, Larry, is that New Hampshire says they're going to have the first in the nation primary, and anything that looks like a primary, they're going to block. And so Iowa is sticking with the caucus, has stuck with the caucus through the years, not to run afoul of New Hampshire.
All right, James, thank you so much. Anything else to add you think our listeners should know about the Iowa caucuses before we let you go?
Well, I would just mention that Republicans are having caucuses too, but we don't expect too much news out of those caucuses, and they're really flying under the radar. Otherwise, like I said, for a lot of Iowans, this is sort of their civic duty to show up and caucus, and they take it very, very seriously. People, covering caucus campaign events, you see many of the same people over and over for multiple candidates. They want to listen to them. They want to meet them. They want to ask them questions. So, yeah, it's a very serious process.
Yeah. Who's favored to win that GOP caucus? James, thanks very much. I appreciate it. Good to have you with us. James Lynch, reporter for The Gazette in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Reminder that NPR will be providing live coverage. You'll hear it right here on KPCC 5 o'clock this afternoon. Coverage from around the state of Iowa, the Iowa caucuses here on KPCC. Then tomorrow evening, 6 o'clock, NPR's live coverage of the State of the Union address by President Trump and the Democratic response right after the President's State of the Union address, as well as analysis from NPR's political experts. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. We're just 10 minutes away from the BBC News Hour. Then Take 2 at 2 o'clock. All of the regular afternoon programming comes your way right after this abbreviated and belated Air Talk. We'll be back in just 1 minute.
Support for LAist comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting an evening in focus, Goya. The museum's galleries come to life at this interactive event, celebrating the opening of the exhibition, I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. Enjoy live music, art-making activities for all ages, live model drawing, tours, and more. Free with museum admission. Saturday, April 20th from 4 to 6:30 p.m. More information at nortonsimon.org.
Kate, you just joined us. Radio host Rush Limbaugh announced to his listeners this morning he's been diagnosed with advanced lung cancer. He said he's going to take some days off for further medical tests and to determine what his treatment is going to be. Limbaugh, of course, highly influential conservative voice, announcing he'll be taking some time off as a result of this diagnosis of advanced lung cancer. Also, just want to share with you that the ratings came out for last week. And the Lakers' first game after the death of Kobe Bryant and his daughter and seven others in that helicopter crash in Calabasas, that game had the second highest regular season NBA rating for ESPN that they have ever had. What makes that, to me, even more remarkable is that in the huge Los Angeles television market, the Lakers' regular Spectrum Sportsnet station was also carrying the game. So a significant percentage of Angelenos that were watching the memorial tribute to Kobe Bryant and the others that were killed, significant number of those were watching the Spectrum Sports Channel feed of the game instead of the ESPN feed. But at its height, just as the pregame memorial was closing, more than 6 million viewers were watching that tribute to Kobe Bryant for a Friday night NBA game. That is an extraordinary rating. Well, we want to check in and bring you the very latest on the novel coronavirus. To talk about that, what's going on with travel restrictions, with diagnosis, and closely following the story has been Los Angeles Times staff writer Alex Wigglesworth. Alex, thank you very much for being with us. Can we start, first of all, with what we know about the extent of this virus and how many people have died as a result of it so far?
Sure. I believe that the most recent numbers, there have been over 300 deaths, most of them in China. In California, there are currently only 6 confirmed cases. There's one in L.A. County, one in Orange County, 2 in San Benito County, and 2 in Santa Clara County. And there are 11 confirmed cases in total in the United States.
And where at this point have health authorities, sort of what level of designation have they given for this in terms of the public health threat?
So the Department of Defense announced over the weekend that it's freed up 1,000 beds for people who may need to be quarantined upon arrival from overseas travel because of the coronavirus. And 2 of the 4 facilities are all military bases are in California. Travis Air Force Base in Solano County, Marine Corps Air Station Miramar in San Diego County. So they are looking at quarantines of travelers returning from overseas. And there are also currently 195 people being quarantined at March Air Reserve Base in Riverside County. Those are the people that flew there last week after being evacuated from the U.S. Embassy in Wuhan, which is believed to be the epicenter of the outbreak. And then on Friday, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention ordered that they be quarantined for 14 days when the plane left China. And that was actually the CDC's first mandatory quarantine in more than 50 years. So this is definitely something that federal officials are taking seriously.
And looking at this internationally, the World Health Organization declared it a global health emergency. But also, we've heard that, you know, it's important not to overreact to it, not to, over-quarantine individuals. What's your sense of how public health officials are attempting to find that balance of being prepared, reacting quickly, but not overreacting?
Sure. I think it's a very delicate balance between, you know, sharing information as quickly as they receive it to make sure that there's not a vacuum where people don't have that information and are sort of making things up themselves. And then not panicking people by sharing too much information, too many updates. Officials have pointed out that many, many more Americans contract the influenza virus every year and even die. Tens of thousands of Americans die of the flu every year. So this certainly isn't on that level. Again, there are only 11 confirmed cases in the United States, and no one has died here. So it's definitely has been a balance that officials have had to tread between, you know, letting people know what's going on, the best way to avoid risk of contracting the virus or passing on the virus, but then also kind of putting it into context and letting people know that, you know, there are much bigger risks to the public health in America than this.
Yeah. One of the concerning points of this, the Department of Homeland Security has warned airline passengers could find themselves rerouted if officials discovered mid-flight that someone aboard had been in China within the past couple of weeks. That would be cause for concern, especially if there was a quarantine that a flight like that was placed under. Do you have any more information on that? And because that, to me, seems like it could have a significant effect on overall international travel, not just flights to Asia.
Sure. So there are only a handful of airports that are equipped to screen passengers that are returning from China. So everyone on a flight would be routed to one of those airports and screened. And that certainly CDC officials have acknowledged that it could be disruptive to travel, but they feel that it's important to take those precautions. The Trump administration also last week declared a public health emergency and announced additional restrictions on people traveling from China to the U.S. So foreign nationals who recently visited China now won't be allowed to enter the U.S. at all. And American citizens returning from mainland China will be subject to 14-day quarantines. Again, that's believed to be the incubation period of the virus. And then those traveling from the Hubei province will likely be quarantined at those military base we talked about, while other U.S. citizens who have visited mainland China will have to undergo a health screening and be ordered to self-quarantine at their home.
One good piece of news, the man who was identified as the first U.S. patient infected with the novel coronavirus has left the hospital. He said he's getting better and looking forward to his life getting back to normal. So we're certainly glad to hear about that. Alex Wigglesworth, Los Angeles Times, closely following the coronavirus story. Thank you for the latest details. We appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. I'm Larry Mantle. Thank you for joining us for a late edition of Air Talk today. Coming up, BBC NewsHour on 89.3. The rest of the afternoon, our typical KPECC schedule, including A. Martinez with you at 2 for Take 2. Tomorrow morning, we're back with you at our regularly scheduled Air Talk time, 10 o'clock to noon. From all of us at Air Talk, have a good day, and we remind you that NPR's live coverage of the Iowa caucuses starts at 5 today.
The LAist Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.